From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we'll have those special open lines for you. Here's what's happening. Wow, I made a bet with Robert Morningstar last night. I thought that the TPP, the fast trade bill, would just pass. It did not. Congress said no. In a dramatic defeat for the White House, President Obama's trade agenda, TPP, ran aground the House as the Democrats banded together in opposition despite a personal plea from the president. The House killed a worker aid bill as well that was tied to the president's main agenda item, legislation that would give the president fast-track authority to negotiate trade deals like that. Without it, the trade push withers, at least for now. The vote marked a stunning blow for the president at the hands of his own party, with Nancy Pelosi and labor unions helping drive the stake into the legislation right in the end. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. This is a remarkable story, John.
Well, it is, but it's a temporary setback because, you know, Pete Sessions from Texas and, you know, John Boehner, you know, the House Speaker, are committed to getting this passed. Now, what the Democratic, especially the liberal wing of the Democratic Party that opposed this and sabotaged it basically for the president, was that they wanted something called TAA. This is Trade Protection. Trade Protection Authority is what the bill is about. It's a fast track for especially Pacific Rim economic legislation. But what the Democrats wanted was protection for people who get their jobs outsourced as a result of this legislation to extend unemployment benefits to these people. That's called TAA, and that was what was taken off the table and why the Democrats opposed it. Now, they think that they can reinstate this. At least Sessions said that by Tuesday, he thinks they'll have enough votes on both sides to get this passed. It's to Obama's advantage. It's to the Republicans. They can't show that they're just a do-nothing Congress between now and the election. Obama, on the other hand, you know, is willing to bend over backwards to show that he can get any kind of legislation through since, you know, the Obamacare passed in 2010. Nothing has gotten done. So that's where it's at.
Okay, John. Thanks. Onlinecolumnist.com. Of course, we oppose the TPP because we just don't think the Europeans need to get together with us with all this trade. The Earth's electrical grids will soon get a little more protection from solar eruptions. Not a lot, but just a little. After flying a million miles since its February 11th launch, the Deep Space Climate Observatory will look to the sun starting next month and warn all of us about solar ejections that can damage Earth's magnetic field and disrupt the grids, global positioning systems, and communications networks. The satellite is part of a system that the U.S. Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado, uses to warn power companies, airlines, and other susceptible industries about potentially adverse conditions. We're still conducting our push, though, to get the grid insulated. As California grapples with a relentless drought, state regulators ordered farmers and others who hold some of the strongest water rights in the state to simply stop all pumping from three major waterways in one of the country's prime farm regions. The order involving record cuts by senior water rights holders in Sacramento, San Joaquin, and the Delta watersheds followed mandatory water curtailment earlier this year to cities and towns and to farmers with less ironclad water rights. Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams. It's on the shelf. Don't eat it. They found Listeria in its plant again and has halted production for the second time since April. The company is based in Ohio. U.S. producer prices in May recorded their biggest increase in more than 2.5 years as the cost of gasoline and food rose, suggesting that an oil-driven downward drift in prices nearing an end. We're going to check in now with Chris Geo, spokesperson for My Patriot Supply. Chris, these food prices, we can't afford to have them skyrocket, but they don't look good right now.
George, it's not only here in the United States, but it is definitely a worldwide concern. Here in the United States, a lot of people don't realize, but we're experiencing one of the biggest bird flu epidemics in history. Now, bird flu doesn't affect humans, so most people don't hear about it, but there's 47 million birds that have been killed in 20 states, more than half in Iowa. That means that the cost of eggs have gone up. That's just the one small piece of the puzzle here. Of course, as you mentioned just a minute ago, the drought in California. California is one of the largest fruit and vegetable producers here in the United States, anyways, of course. And they're very very big on their agriculture. I remember when I went into California the first time, I hit one of those agricultural checkpoints, which took me very much by surprise. But that's how serious they are about their produce. Now, meanwhile, we've got flooding in Houston, which isn't adding any help to the problem at all. Monsoon rains in India. This is right after extreme heat. They're worried about their food supply. Turkey food prices are a whopping 20% higher than the global average.
Jeez.
Nigeria got hit the hardest, though. Their food is already high enough as it is, considering what the economy is, but their prices increased 100%. In order to really understand what's going on, you've got to look at food prices over the last few decades. I mean, let's just look at fast food, because I know we're limited on time, but a Big Mac in 1968 was 49 cents. Now it's $4.79.
Wow.
15 pieces of chicken from KFC was $4.99. Now a meal like that is upwards of $42.99. So there is a big, big problem brewing. That's not to mention that Greece right now has been given a week to deal with the whole Eurozone creditor situation. The stock market dropped 140 points today. Oil prices, as you mentioned, are around $60 a barrel. People are worried about oversupply now, when just a few years ago we were talking about peak oil. The term peak oil was spoken more often than have a nice day was. It's brewing for something really bad, George, and I hate to say it, but 2015 to 2017 is the time we've got to look out for. I'm going to talk to you in 2018. We're going to have a discussion right here on Coast, and it's going to be a sad discussion, because you're going to say, Chris, a lot of things you said were right.
I'm afraid you may be right. You got it. Chris, thanks. Chris Geo. So if you go to Zimbabwe and you pull out one American dollar, just one, right now you'll be able to exchange it for 35 quadrillion Zimbabwe dollars. That's right. One U.S. dollar will get you 35 quadrillion local dollars in Zimbabwe. If you think you want to have a lot of money, just bring $10. Guess how much you'll have. Let's check in the skies these days. It's Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center with his weekly update on what's going on in the skies. Peter, what do we have?
Well, there's been a lot of inflation in the skies above the United States as well, George. A lot of interesting reports, although I preface by pointing out to our listeners that these reports are not yet posted to our website. Our webmaster's on a short trip, and we'll have them posted probably Monday.
Well, we're ahead of the game here. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah. Chicago, going back to Saturday night, June 6th, 10:15 p.m., local time, central time, an adult couple standing outside at that time, and their attention was drawn to a bizarre cluster of lights of some variety to the northeast of their position. As they stood there over the next several seconds, they realized that those lights were attached to something that was very large and very triangular in shape. Long story short, it glided directly overhead. When it was directly overhead, totally silent, they reported that it was about the size of 3 25-cent piece coins edge to edge, so it was a very large object, much bigger than the full moon. Two nights later, Monday of this week, the 8th of June, many reports from the state of Florida. We got 13 reports in about an hour, George. Very unusual.
That is unusual.
I hope to have those posted very soon. People will find them very interesting. One of the better, more well-written ones is, ironically, from Davenport, Florida. A couple saw two triangular craft pass overhead, very similar to the report from Chicago. We'll have those posted very soon. This morning at 3:45 a.m., New Orleans, a gentleman saw a cobalt blue light streak across the sky, go behind some local buildings. I'd like to just read a few words of his sentence. He said, "I've seen many meteors in my life. This definitely was not one." We'll have that report posted to our website very soon. And the last report comes from Beaumont, California, Riverside County. this evening at 7 p.m. Gentlemen standing outside, broken clouds, beautiful nighttime or evening sky. He was looking at some soaring birds directly above him, and his attention was immediately drawn to a black object, a disc, he feels, that was just in the bases of the clouds above his head. It was moving very rapidly from east to west. It flew into a cloud, disappeared from his sight, and 1 to 2 seconds after it disappeared from his sight, a propeller-driven airplane came out of the same cloud. It must have passed very close to a propeller-driven craft that was just descending out of the broken overcast. So a lot's going on. We'll have these reports posted probably Monday of the upcoming week.
Okay, UFOCenter.com. Thank you, Peter. Well, the Bilderbergs are meeting in Austria. And do they dabble in the occult? Up next, Mitch Horowitz joins us as we talk about world leaders and the occult next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mitch Horowitz with us again. Mitch was raised in a world of Bigfoot stories, UFO sightings, Carlos Castaneda books. He grew up determined to find the truth behind all of it. He's written on everything from War on Witches to The Secret Life of Ronald Reagan. He's vice president, editor-in-chief at Tarcher Penguin, and that is a division of Penguin Books, which is dedicated to metaphysical literature. And he also hosts Origins, his web series on the history of superstitions. Mitch, always good to have you on the show, my friend. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, George. Glad to be here.
Lots to talk with you about, but we're going to key in on what's going on with the occult and world leaders. You know, the Bilderbergs are meeting in Austria right now,
yes.
And God knows what they're concocting for us. But what have you found out about their dabbling in the occult?
Well, you know, my experience has been that interest in the occult among people who are part of the power elite usually has less to do with a given organization, like a Bilderberg or one of the other financial groups, although there are accountability questions that are very important there. Usually it tends to be a personal proclivity. You find it in the personality and the practices of the individual. For example, the person who may be our next president, Hillary Clinton, in the first term of her husband's administration, she invited a New Age guru, a person I like very, very much, named Jean Houston, into the White House for conferences, and they had a variety of sessions which were later characterized in the Washington Post as seances, where they were attempting to channel the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, I think seances is probably an exaggeration in that case, but this was a situation where in the White House, in the private residence, not only Hillary, but also Bill, for a period of time, sat in on some of these sessions. So you'll find these things expressed more in the life of individuals than you will within given organizations.
When the SEALs raided Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan, did they not find something that dealt with the occult?
Yes, I was absolutely blown away. The Navy SEALs found a book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. Manly P. Hall was an occult philosopher who died in 1990. He was kind of a hero to me. I've based a lot of my career on Manly P. Hall, frankly, and I've published his book, The Secret Teachings, for many, many years. I've written extensively about Manly. He was a huge influence on me. And there I find my hero's book, this wonderful occult mystical encyclopedia, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, is on the bookshelf of the most notorious terrorist of the 21st century. You could have knocked me over with a feather, but those are the facts.
What would he do with that book?
I was astonished by it. The reason I think bin Laden gravitated toward that book is that Manly had a theory that there were a network of secret societies, including Freemasons, Rosicrucians, members of the Illuminati, which, you know, people have sinister associations with the Illuminati. In many ways, they were a wonderful group. They existed in Bavaria around the time of the American Revolution. They supported separation of church and state. They valued political equality. They believed in radical ecumenism. And yes, they were also involved in occult rituals and ceremonies. Manly believed that a network of these groups, extending back to ancient Egypt, up through the Renaissance, up through the founding of America and the flowering of the New World, had vouchsafed a variety of principles that undergirded our own Constitution and Declaration of Independence. And they bided their time over generations and generations and waited for an opportunity when there would be the flowering, the development of a society where these principles could be fully enacted. The idea that every individual is an extension of the Creator, the idea that all religions are to be treated equally, the idea that each individual can pursue his or her own sacred ideal of happiness. These were ideals that Manley thought were vouchsafed by secret societies through history and eventually flowered in the New World. And Manley wasn't the only one who believed this. Ronald Reagan also believed this, because as I've demonstrated in a variety of articles in Salon, The Washington Post, other places, Reagan quoted chapter and verse from Manley P. Hall. So here you have a book that's on Bin Laden's bookshelf that's being read, perhaps, by this notorious terrorist, that was also read by one of the most effective recent American presidents. I think Bin Laden was attracted to it because he thought it would teach him about this vast conspiracy of Freemasons, Rosicrucians, and other secret fraternity members that led to the flowering of the United States. Reagan believed that. He talked about it in certain speeches and documents. He thought it was a good thing. We can obviously presume Bin Laden thought it was a bad thing.
Mitch, why is it that when we hear stories of the supernatural and the occult, and specifically this program, we're okay with it? But then when you hear that a president or a first lady is dabbling in the same thing, it feels a little eerie. How come?
People are worried about sinister forces, but I think at the heart of it, they're worried about a lack of accountability in contemporary society, and that's a legitimate concern. God only knows what's in the trade bill that you were discussing at the top of the hour. You know, it's very, very difficult for people to plow through the vast complexities, not only of laws that come out of Washington, but at the language that's hidden inside their health insurance policies. They're right to be concerned. Sometimes they project those concerns onto occult and religious and mystical practices. My contention has long been that these things have been very, very good for the flowering of life in the Western world. I think Freemasonry has been a wonderful influence. I think it's injected a lot of good civics into our society. I would say the same about the very short-lived organization called the Illuminati, which Thomas Jefferson defended. I don't think these are sinister groups. I think these are groups that have vouchsafed some very important ideas. But people are concerned about accountability, and that's valid.
Jimmy Carter, of course, talked about seeing a UFO. Ronald Reagan has done that. Richard Nixon would seek a psychic. There was a psychic, might have been the same one, Gene Dixon.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Predicted Kennedy's death. Go ahead.
Yes, that's right. I was just writing about that tonight. I have a post about that on Facebook. Dixon was a very interesting figure. She became famous in the 1960s because she gave an interview to Parade magazine in 1956. And in this interview, she said that the election of 1960 would be won by a Democrat and that he would die in office. And people felt, wow, Gene Dixon, the psychic, predicted the assassination of JFK. So she became very popular for the remaining years of her life. She died in 1997. She was a psychic advisor and an astrologer to the Reagans, but she fell out of favor with the Reagans because she actually said Ronald Reagan was not going to make it to the Oval Office, that he was going to stay in the State House in California. And Nancy did not like that, and she moved on to other astrologers, including Joan Quigley, who was the astrologer that was advising Nancy when all of this went public in the second term of the Reagan administration. Gene Dixon did have, in 1972, an Oval Office session with Richard Nixon. It is an absolute fact because it was preserved on Nixon's Watergate tapes. Dixon was friends with Nixon's secretary, a woman named Rosemary Woods.
Rosemary Woods, that's right.
Yeah. And Rosemary managed to get Gene Dixon, the psychic, into a session with Richard Nixon in 72. He didn't seem very impressed by anything that she said, but he did talk about it with Henry Kissinger. This is on White House tapes. And he said that Dixon was very concerned about radical groups taking hostages and thought that they had to have some sort of a contingency plan. I don't know how seriously Nixon ultimately took it, but can you imagine? Right there in the Oval Office, there's Nixon, not someone you think of as a man of occult passions, having a session with one of the 20th century's most famous psychics.
It's amazing, and we'll be back with more in a moment. Well, Mitch is also an expert on superstition, so we'll talk with him about some of that. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him as we talk about the occult. And welcome back, Mitch. I want to get into some of the superstitions a little bit later on with you. They've sure. always interested me. But back to some of these politicos.
Yep.
Skull and Bones out at Yale University.
Yeah.
So many presidents and powerful leaders came from that organization. Is there anything weird about that?
Well, you know, I probably get more questions about Skull and Bones than any other single organization. You know, the fact is, for the most part, I think Skull and Bones is a very elite eating club for rich kids, many of whom are very tightly connected and tied into power. But if you look into the lives of some of the individuals who came out of Skull and Bones, you find things that are a little more interesting. George W. Bush was a member of Skull and Bones. Now, he presented himself as an evangelical Christian. His brother today, Jeb, is running for president. He's a part of the Catholic faith. Their dad, George H.W., was somebody who didn't talk much about religion in public, but, you know, was sort of a straight arrow mainstream guy. The fact is, the Bush family has occult roots in this country, and it is an absolute fact. The first prominent Bush in America was a mystical spiritualist minister, the Reverend George Bush, who in the mid-19th century was famous for defending psychics, seances, mediums. He attended seances with Edgar Allan Poe. There was a psychic here in New York named Andrew Jackson Davis. He was from the Hudson Valley. The Reverend George Bush was a big defender of Davis's, and he said that Davis gave him some sort of a phenomenally produced letter, some sort of a letter that was derived from the afterworld, which contained lessons from the spirit of Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a Swedish scientist and mystic. Now, where I live on the east side of Manhattan, two blocks away from me is a Swedenborgian church where the Reverend George Bush presided until his death in 1859. He was a supernatural figure who was an avid follower of seances, mesmerism, and so forth. So if there's a skeleton in the Bush family tree, that's it. They never talk about him. I don't even know personally if they are aware of him. But if you ever look at a picture of him, and you can find it online, you put in Reverend George Bush, he is the spitting image of George W. Bush. Imagine George W. Bush with a beard, and you will be looking at his doppelganger, his double. That's where the Bush family comes from in this country.
Mitch, tell us the incredible story of Andrew Johnson commuting the death sentence of a sailor because everybody thought the sailor was a vampire.
Yeah, one of the weirdest pieces of presidential history in our country. Now, Andrew Johnson, of course, took over for Abraham Lincoln after Lincoln's assassination. And the following year, there was this bizarre episode that got reported about in newspapers where there was a sailor on a whaling ship who was said to have killed and drank the blood of two other unfortunate sailors. And the man was captured. He was sentenced to life in prison. He actually spent his time in an asylum for the criminally insane. And Andrew Johnson, for reasons that are absolutely lost to history, pardoned him. He was supposed to receive the death penalty. He was supposed to be hanged. But Johnson issued a presidential pardon. Now, this is quite a rare thing. Why would a U.S. president get involved in issuing a presidential pardon, issuing a stay of execution to somebody who was accused of committing a brutal act of murder, and if what the newspapers reported was accurate, drank the blood of the victims? This was a macabre, bizarre crime by any standard. The facts may have been different from what was reported in the newspaper, but there was a murder committed, and it was on a ship, and this man seemed to be guilty. Why would Johnson pardon him? People called this figure a vampire. You know, he was thought in some ways to be a model for Bram Stoker's Dracula, because Bram Stoker at the time was poring over newspapers from that era and looking for stories of vampires, which he later incorporated into his famous novel and character. And, of course, one of the main scenes in Dracula involves the Count crossing the ocean on a ship and feeding off of sailors. Sounds a lot like this story. So there may be some connection there. Why would Andrew Johnson pardon a man that the newspapers called a vampire? We don't know, but the pardon order exists. The one thing historians don't understand is the motive. It's a very strange episode in presidential history.
Mitch, and it seems that a lot of our politicos dabbled with the unusual, dabbled in the occult, didn't they?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You find among high-powered people some of the same trends that you find among everyday people. So you will find very high-powered people who are interested in aspects of New Age, mysticism, the occult. Now take Jimmy Carter, for example. Carter is a Baptist Christian. He's a church-going man. He's a Sunday school teacher. He has spoken very forthrightly and very bravely about witnessing UFOs. And also, during his presidency in 1978, the CIA had a psychic spy program, which was called Operation Stargate, where remote viewers and psychics were used to try to gather intelligence, mostly military intelligence. Carter has spoken and written publicly about that program's success in 1978 in finding a downed Soviet military jet in Central Africa. The CIA was very interested in reaching this jet because it contained a lot of sensitive Soviet intelligence gathering technology. It was understood that the jet crashed in Central Africa. No one knew where it was. There were two remote viewers from the CIA's Operation Stargate program who went into a kind of relaxed trance state. They were able to come up with the coordinates of the plane, of the crash site, and a CIA search team got there before a Soviet retrieval team was able to get there and was able to secure some apparently valuable intelligence. Carter spoke about this to a group of students in Atlanta. He wrote about it in his diaries. He spoke about it in cabinet meetings. He stood behind this. Now, Bill Clinton later put an end to that program. It wasn't a very expensive program. It only ran about $20 million a year, which by government standards ain't much.
No.
But Bill Clinton was trying to cut costs after the Cold War was over, and Operation Stargate got cut. But Jimmy Carter, this very forthright, straightforward guy, is a believer in UFOs and personally testified to the success of the CIA's psychic spy program in that episode in 1978.
When I introduced you, you were, of course, raised in a world of incredible Bigfoot stories, UFO sightings. Teddy Roosevelt,
yes,
believer in Bigfoot.
My favorite Bigfoot story of all time. Teddy Roosevelt, in the 1890s, spent time on an extended hunting expedition in the Dakota territories. Now, of course, this is wilderness area. And Roosevelt, in one of his memoirs, wrote a very vivid and chilling story that was told to him by his hunting guide, that the guide said that he and a friend of his were stalked by a Bigfoot-like creature, this creature with fangs that was capable of sucking blood out of men and animals, that walked upright, that left enormous tracks. And this hunting guide told Teddy Roosevelt that one very desolate, frightening night, the guide was returning to camp, smack in the middle of the Dakota Territories, real wilderness land, and he said everything was silent. There were no birds, there were no crickets, there were no animal noises, and he saw that the fire, he could see from a distance, that the fire at the campsite had gone out. He got to the campsite, and he saw that his hunting partner was there, laying dead on the ground. He had incisions in his neck that were apparently made by teeth. His blood was sucked out of his neck. there were these enormous footprints around the camp that he and his partner had noticed earlier, and his partner's body had apparently been rolled around. It was all covered with leaves and debris, and he got out of there as quickly as he possibly could. But this is one of the earliest Bigfoot narratives in American history, and Teddy Roosevelt took it so seriously that he committed several pages to it in one of his own memoirs. It's written with tremendous vividness. It's very frightening, and this Bigfoot-like creature in the 19th century, according to Roosevelt's hunting guide, killed the guide's partner, and it was a very chilling story, and Roosevelt was chilled by it as well.
Did any of them have any dealings with the late American prophet Edgar Cayce?
Now, that's a really wonderful question. Here is an absolute fact. Franklin Roosevelt's second vice president was a man named Henry Wallace. I love Wallace. Wallace was a remarkable man who was interested in astrology, mysticism, theosophy, all kinds of occult philosophies. Wallace was supposed to have a reading from Edgar Cayce, but Edgar died in January of 1945 before the reading could be delivered. The remarkable thing about Edgar Cayce was, and he was a great medical clairvoyant, psychic, a Christian mystic who lived and worked in the early 20th century, Edgar didn't care if you were a president, if you were a movie star, or if you were an ordinary laborer. You went on the same list. He would get to people as he could get to them. You would take a number, you would wait your turn. Edgar did two readings a day, and it didn't matter what your name was, how much money you had, you would go to the bottom of the list. So Vice President Henry Wallace went right to the bottom of the list, and unfortunately, Edgar died before that reading could be given. There are persistent rumors that Edgar gave a reading to President Woodrow Wilson during the First World War. But those stories have never been fully substantiated. It is a possibility because some of the people around Wilson were close to Edgar and some of his confidants. It's never been definitively proven, but it's a real possibility.
Are the Freemasons, are they getting a bad rap?
I believe absolutely the Freemasons are getting a bad rap. I'm one of those people who will stand up and defend Masonry anytime in any setting. In this country, Masonry has been a wonderful influence. Many of the founders were Masons. This includes George Washington, Ben Franklin, Paul Revere, John Hancock. And fraternal organizations, of course, meant a great deal in the colonial age. America was an agricultural nation. Your ties were to your church, your farm, or whatever business you were in, and whatever fraternal organizations you belonged to. So when people belonged to Masonry back then, it really meant something. It was a fundamental commitment in their lives. I believe some of the values of religious liberty, political equality, ecumenism that ran through the writings and the ideas of the American founders were influenced in a positive way by Freemasonry. I think Masonry has been a wonderful influence in American history.
I think so, too. It really, though, has gotten that bum rap.
It has gotten a terrible rap. You know, Freemasons are trying to do something about that today. They have open houses where you can go into the Masonic lodges. I've spoken at lodges in Colorado, in New York City, other places. And it's a wonderful fraternal organization. Many of the folks who go there today for social purposes, charitable purposes. But there is a crop of younger Masons, and they're really interested in the esoteric side of Masonry. And I applaud that because I think that's just a fascinating field. In a lot of ways, Masonry preserved some of the symbols and the ideas that came out of the occult flowering during the Renaissance. During the Renaissance here in the West, people were rediscovering the ancient religions that had disappeared from Egypt, Greece, Rome, and Masonry adopted many of the symbols from those religions. They weren't necessarily trying to echo or mimic those religions, but they were trying to say, look, there is this great search for meaning. There's this great search for God that goes back to deepest antiquity. We're part of that. The ancient Egyptians were part of that. The Greeks were part of that. The Romans were part of that. We, in the modern world, can be part of that too. So the Masons adopt all these different religious symbols because they believe the religious search is universal. And to me, that's a that's a sign of health in that organization.
Of the candidates that are out there right now, outside of Hillary Clinton that you had mentioned, anybody else dabbling in the occult?
You know, nothing that's specifically come to my attention. Hillary is the number one figure because of those very intriguing White House sessions that she held during Bill's first term. And Bob Woodward of the Washington Post classified those sessions as seances. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. There aren't any candidates right now who, at least it hasn't come to my attention, who have specific ties to mystical or occult groups. John Kerry, when he was running for office, his wife was very interested in various New Age practices and such. So sometimes it'll enter through the spouse, and that's always something to watch for. You know, what is the spouse interested in? That may be where we'll learn some different sides to some of these figures.
Mitch, what drives you? What keeps you going into this very unusual field you're in?
The search for meaning, the search for meaning. And ultimately, George, and you know, you and I have talked about this before, once you get past all the mysteries, all the mysticism, all the different methods, it all is about becoming a better person for other people to live with, you know? And if it's not contributing to that, then, you know, I'm just attaching myself to things that are just for show, that just belong in a museum case somewhere. I do believe there is an invisible world that exists side by side with our own. I do believe we have lives that go beyond the flesh and blood. And if we can come into a fuller sense of who we are, hopefully we become better community members, better husbands and wives, better people for others to be around. That's really what all these mysteries are supposed to do. They're supposed to create better men and women. That's what Freemasonry is about. So I'd say that's what keeps me going.
Have you always believed in this?
Yes, I have. I really have. You know, as a little kid, I remember, you know, tearing through my sister's Carlos Castaneda book. I couldn't quite understand all of it, but I knew something was there. And, you know, I grew up at a great time. You know, in the 1970s, you would see the Maharishi on television, and Merv Griffin would bring out Sidney Omar, the astrologer. And I was fascinated with all this stuff from the earliest age. And I just felt in my guts that something was there. And as a very young kid, I began to explore folklore, astrology, superstition, Bigfoot stories. It's a mysterious world, and I always had a feeling for it in my gut.
Were you an Aleister Crowley fan?
I've never really been a big Crowley fan. I don't personally like the way Crowley lived his life. I think a lot of people around Crowley got hurt. I don't think he was a Satanist. I don't view him in that way. I view him as kind of a brilliant rebel. I view him as a guy who wanted to take a sledgehammer to all kinds of traditions. But he also took a sledgehammer sometimes, metaphorically, to people around him. And he would go on mountain climbing trips or drug binges or travels that proved very dangerous to people around him. And there were a lot of broken people, a lot of hurt people around Crowley. So I've never personally been an admirer of his, but I do think there's a certain genius that runs through his work.
Of all the stories you've uncovered, which one frightens you the most, Mitch?
The thing that frightens me the most, and I come back to it again and again, is the Ouija board.
Oh, me too.
Creepy story.
And you've heard about this new one out, Charlie, that the kids are playing?
Yeah.
Dangerous.
It's scary stuff, and it's funny because Hasbro is always redesigning the Ouija board to make it more and more benign.
Yeah,
you know, they'll put it in pink so that
make it look fun.
Teenage girls and so forth. Scariest stories I've ever heard have come through the Ouija board, and I've had creepy experiences with it myself. I've had people write me emails out of the blue, telling me, "I think you're considering dabbling with the Ouija board, and I want to warn you off from it." And then, you know, the emails get creepier and creepier, and you know, sometimes these things come to me without my having publicly even talked about experimenting with the Ouija board, not confiding it to anybody. Every time somebody breaks open that box and starts to use the planchette, something creepy happens.
Something's going to happen. Mitch, we're going to come back. I want to talk with you a little bit about some superstitions, and then we'll take an hour of phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.